fresco leads the eye into the view of hills, layers of hills, blue going darker, the cones of two extinct volcanoes you see from the windows. A smart and fun painting. The view from the real windows is blear now, but the witty replica may inspire someone who finally buys this place to recreate the original garden. Most interesting is this. Off to the right side, two figures are seated, looking out at the view beyond a balustrade. You see the people only from behind, and they are in shadow, only a suggestion of a woman wearing a rose-printed shawl, a man with his head tilted, contemplative. They must be the original owners, the S monogram, looking out at their splendid garden. On the other side, a black and white bird perches in the leaves of a potted orange tree. "Do you know who painted the fresco?" I ask. "Mama always said it was a nun. 200 or 300 years ago. She left the convent in some disgrace and survived by painting scenes in villas. Someone should study this. A few other villas have what looks like the same hand. I prefer bare walls, but would never paint over this, because my mama would rise out of the grave." "Oh, the black and white bird," Mama said, "symbolizes the nun's habit." Upstairs, we examine the beds, and I have plenty to advise. "Get rid of these chicken feather pillows, they stab you in the night. Some new sheets. These are pretty vintage ones, but hard to dry." I've been almost rope-burned on heavy linen sheets before. "Your mother, grandmother, crocheted the coverlet?" "Starched snowflakes, 1,000 of them." "Grandmother, one of the treasures of the house, but I will leave it on the bed." "You know, Grazia, Americans like to read in bed. I'd get some lights with more wattage." "More wattage than one candle, I think. Italians always say they don't read in bed, they make love. Even luxury hotels often have bedside lamps no brighter than nightlights." "I don't know about that. They seem fine to me." In the downstairs bathroom, mildew rings the shower. It reeks like stagnant frog water. "All these towels, I'd replace them. Americans are used to soft towels. I know the Italians aren't, mainly because they dry theirs outside." I don't add that these thin antiques feel like emery boards. Grazia is surprised, having never met a soft towel. "That's expensive. For the whole house?" "Believe me." A rank drain smell rises from the kitchen sink. The vintage vacuum cleaner with its deflated balloon bag must be from the 50s. I'd say a new one is a priority, and also mops. Disgusting, the ragged gray mop and a broom with the straw half worn away. We go through the drawers and shelves and make a list. A couple of nonstick frying pans, a sturdy pasta pot, Louisa's is dented aluminum, a good colander, wooden spoons, rancid, that didn't usher in the last century, new dish towels, mixing bowls, a large steamer. Grazia balks at the idea of a coffee maker or espresso machine, and vetoes any kind of food processor or mixer. Her mother made everything by hand. And a mocha pot is just fine. "Should I tune the piano? Remove all the books? They're in Italian." "Leave them. These people are coming to Italy, after all. Who knows if anyone will play? You could wait on that if you want." One room crammed with trunks and boxes and furniture will remain as is. 7 bedrooms is enough. Grazia still has to empty each armadio upstairs. Louisa left some prize evening dresses and tailored suits. A vintage shop in Florence would scoop them up, but Grazia will give them to her aunt, who will someday leave them again for Grazia to dispose of. Whoever lands here is lucky. There's some funk, but the villa has noble bones and gracious spaces. My own place is more intimate and suits us, but I think to wake up here would expand your mind every day. I visualize making love with Colin in every one of the bedrooms and on the divano in front of the living room fireplace. Climbing up to the Roman road that leads to the monastery, I shift to remembering what's real. We have our spot beneath a stone wall high up on the land, a dip in the thick grasses where we take our green blanket on Sunday afternoons after our pranzo of salads and roast guinea hen, and on warm nights for the stars. So far, no wild boar has nosed our bare bodies. Then I reposition my earbuds and turn on the voice of Nicole Kidman reading To the Lighthouse. White Wisteria. Bliss to wake up to the sound of waves rolling in. Julia is the first one up. When Camille and Susan wander into the kitchen in their robes around 9, she has waffle batter ready, juice poured, and a pan of bacon already made. "You accomplish everything effortlessly," Camille says. "I consider it a major event when Charlie brings his family over for quiche and salad for Sunday brunch. And how orderly the kitchen is. My secret weapon, clean up as you go." After breakfast and a beach walk, they drive into Wilmington, where the gracious neighborhoods invite them to stroll and make up stories about the inhabitants of the white houses all surrounded by pink and white azaleas. They buy carnations and lavender soaps for Susan's house and stop for ice cream cones in the old town. After lunch at a waterfront cafe, Susan finds new walking shoes, and Julia shows them some of Mulberry Press's publications in the bookstore. In the art section of the bookstore, Camille selects tubes of watercolor paint, 6 brushes, and paper. "I might as well paint a big cliched sunset," she jokes. But she's excited to think of taking the paints down to the dunes. This is the first time she's bought paints in how many years? She cannot remember. By 3, they're back at Sandcastle and out on the beach with Archie. "Julia, tell us the rest, if you will," Susan says. "You know how the crime novels always have the hook propelling you from chapter to chapter? I'm dying to know about Wade." "That is if you want to," Camille adds. She wonders if Susan is not being a bit pushy. "That daughter, Lizzie, what a disaster." "Yes, I'll try." "I'm sure you've guessed what happened next. I could hardly blame him. We were both morose. I sort of wished I'd met some cute guy. But," she laughs, "there's not an abundance of cute 60-year-olds out there." "Wade went way down the age scale. I think she was around 30. 33, maybe." "Is he still seeing her?" Susan asks. "No idea. If we hadn't endured the long Lizzie ordeal, I think I would have been strong enough to weather a betrayal, though I doubt that would have happened. But after all the rocky years, it seemed non-negotiable to me. We'd always had each other. It was like the keystone fell out of the arch. Here's how it all came down. Wade always had a huge temper. I was silly enough to be thrilled with it at first. It showed he was passionate, and he was. He was jealous of anyone I looked at, or he imagined I looked at. He was one of those Southern boys who go to Woodbury Forest and UGA, then return home, more Southern than ever, to work in the family business. His daddy owned a Bowdoin Supply marine paint company. Wade loves the water, loves sailing. Fitting in at Georgia Marine was easy. He's 6'2", green eyes, deep, the color of malachite. I used to melt when he looked my way. Even though his father was black-haired and his mother, too, she was Jewish and warm-skinned, Wade's hair is blonde as an angel's. Who knows how the gene pool twirls? When I met him, I was so physically attracted to him that I never considered anything beyond his heavenly shoulders, racehorse legs, skin the color of honey with the sun in it, and his great smile that promised and delivered the moon and stars. My parents were won over, too, even though he wasn't quite our social class. Things like that really mattered in Savannah. Not as much now. We were wildly happy. When Lizzie was born, she was our darling. Those were the days, my friend. Any chinks? Oh, Wade lost his temper at a slow waiter and turned over his chair getting out of the restaurant before we were served. And he might have invented road rage. He told off one of Lizzie's teachers when she said Lizzie needed to be more organized. And there was the incident in CVS when a prescription wasn't ready. Security escorted him out. Lizzie and I were exempt from his anger attacks. I told myself he was under stress, etc. And after Lizzie's problem started, he was. Okay. Moving on to after Lizzie left the last time, when we started pulling away from each other. I couldn't bear the devastation. I threw myself into work. I learned later he threw himself onto Rose Welton, his new marketing consultant and web designer. I only met her once at the company holiday party. She has puffy lips that must be pumped full of something. They look like two boiled shrimp. Oh, meow. She's pretty enough. He was coming home late, dinner meetings, an Atlanta trip, and he flew to Jacksonville for a boat show. I hardly noticed. I watched escape movies on Netflix and the endless series about the wimpy Scottish Laird. Even if I could barely look at him, I assumed this stage would pass and that we'd eventually get back to a normal or new normal life. When he left one night, I caught a scent of the cologne I gave him for his birthday. Verbena, woodsy and musky. $80. Very provocative. Ding, ding, Sherlock Holmes. Where are you going for dinner? I asked him. Oh, we'll just go to the club. These reps will like that. You already know I'm a snooper. I looked in Lizzie's bag and found drugs. But only when I'm desperate. He left. He'd been online, and his computer hadn't shut down yet. I looked at his credit card bills, all paid automatically, and I don't see them. There was plenty to make my blood boil, including some Jacksonville expenses at boutiques and the hotel spa, 4 restaurant charges in Atlanta, and more at places out from Savannah. Also, really extravagant florist bills. I remembered that he'd brought me a small nosegay of daisies not long ago. I felt as if I had a grease fire in the brain pan. Those silly daisies must have assuaged his guilt over the French tulips or roses he splurged on. Roses, now that I think back, because of her name. An hour after he left, I drove through the club parking lot. No black Range Rover. Obviously, he was dining elsewhere. Where would he take someone after dinner, I wondered. Surely not to a local hotel. Maybe her place? Is she married? Then I realized. The boat. Of course. So, this little detective drives to the marina where my dad keeps Suncatcher, his sailboat. It's really our boat now. I parked at the shadowy far end of the lot. We keep the cabin key in a hatch under the cushions. I let myself in, then pocketed the key. I latched the door from inside without turning on any lights. As I sat there, I had to ask myself what I would do with the information I was about to acquire. I had no idea. I kept thinking, so this is how it feels. I thought, this is not going to happen. In about an hour, I saw lights swing into the lot, and lo and behold, through the curtain I saw Wade, always the gentleman, opening the door for a sweet thing. Arm in arm, they walked to the boat and he helped her in. She sat down and, I couldn't see much out of the crack in the curtain, adjusted a scarf around her neck. He opened the hatch and then let it slam. He tried the door, and I heard him sputter something, then stop short. There are no windows on the front of the cabin, and I'd pulled the curtains along the side. I must have left the key at work, he said. Damn, this is embarrassing. She said something. They left. I waited, cold and revolted. On impulse, I looked in the galley fridge. Champagne. Good champagne. I popped the cork and poured myself a glass. The bed in the bow was spread with the contour sheets my mother had someone make for the boat, and that enraged me again. I poured another glass, turned on the ship to shore, and listened to static communications out on the water. I sent Wade a message. Spending the night at my dad's. I wasn't ready to face the truth just yet. Instead of their having a sex fest in that bow bed, I slept there, rather soundly. They sit down on a log. Camille wants to take out her paints from her bag. As she listens to Julia's story, she looks at clouds, the horizon, the wavy waterline, wondering what instant of these images she might capture, and if she could blend white with a speck of blue to capture the silvery edge of the foam as the wave retreated. Julia continues. I sat on the news. I avoid confrontation if possible, but it was not going to be possible. I arranged a leave of absence at work, with the proviso that I could freelance edit for them. That's when I saw the notice in the paper that Hugh was speaking. That's when he offered his house. I told my dad and Allison, my neighbor. I shredded papers, gave away a pile of my clothes and books I'd never reread. Some fanatical instinct took over. I completely cleaned and ordered the house, except for Lizzie's room, which I left just as it was, down to a pile of sweatpants and T-shirts on her closet floor. I guess he found the flat champagne on the boat. He never mentioned it. I remained cordial to Wade, small talk and dinner on the table. But he picked up on my smoldering anger, and one morning called me cold as a cod. That afternoon, can you imagine? I cleaned our bathroom's grout with a toothbrush and Q-tips. Then I loaded my car. He came home to change for sailing with clients, and I finally confronted him as I shoved my cookbooks into a box. He tried to get my keys and almost broke my finger. He was shouting and denying and blaming. And that's how I'm through with other people's lies and dramas. You must be PTSD, or at least in deep shock. That's quite a pileup of bad, Susan responds, and Camille agrees. Would it help to talk to someone? I have a friend who's very good. I'm talking to you. That's better. After all the shrinks and clinics with Lizzie, I'm done with that. I don't want to backslide into them anymore. When someone is hell-bent, all that talk is useless. I need space to figure out how to live, how to silence the voices that keep clamoring for my life. No, not those kinds of voices, not hallucinations, memories. Now I want forward motion, my feet out of quicksand. Camille opens her bag and takes out her new sketch pad. Yes, you need exactly that, she says. Let's start with a watercolor of this spot right here. You can hang it as a reminder of a turning point. Every time the quicksand beckons, you look at this and listen to the waves and think about good friends. She stands up and hugs Julia. Let's go up, Julia. I'm famished. Susan whistles for Archie. I'm going to run you a bath with mimosa salts. Candles around the tub. You need to chill, big time. She rests her hand on Julia's shoulder and they head for the house. Camille opens the tube of blue. Other lives, she thinks. Exhausting. The spring days beginning to lengthen bring back sweet, lingering twilights. Darkness, no longer plopping over the land like a velvet stage curtain, gives in to the light more every day, allowing a vast space to play at sunset with flamingo, mauve tending to gray, and azure with a glittering edge. As the friends prepare their feast of shrimp and crab, Susan opens the doors onto the back deck and calls them out. The western sky over the marsh behind the house is filled with cotton bowl clouds, the bottoms fluffy and rufous. Through layers of tints, the orb of sun wobbles gently down. Fertilized egg yolk, Julia says. Camille says, fireball. Susan says, sun. When they gather around the fire after dinner, Susan brings out her laptop. Just look, she indicates the screen. You don't have to say anything. Before them appears a square stone house on a slope of olive trees. On one side, a pergola droops with white wisteria. Behind the house lie distant hills and two conical peaks. Extinct volcanoes, Susan said. We could lease this house. It's right outside San Rocco, Tuscany. It's an hour from the sea, and not far from Florence. Firenze, I should say. Camille and Julia look at her quizzically and frown, then laugh. A lease with an option to buy, Susan adds. Isn't it beautiful? The wisteria is white, not purple. Most people plant purple. This is a sign. I've looked all over the internet and at all my sources, even looked in France and Spain. This is the most appealing place I found. I think we would love it. And it does not simplify. It complicates. Susan, years ago, had fallen hard for Tuscany when she and Aaron celebrated their 20th anniversary there. She always meant to get back, but never has. Are you suggesting that we lease? You mean move there? Julia marvels. What an idea! Susan, you are one bold sister. Camille rotates the screen to see better. Click on the inside shots. Beamed rooms with high ceilings flash by, peach, cream, pale yellow, white, each with large stone-framed windows. The kitchen has a real butcher's chopping block on sturdy legs, a long, shallow marble sink that reminds her of cloistered nuns chanting, work tables instead of counters, and all shapes of pots and pans around the biggest fireplace she's ever seen. Julia, look at those pots. Little Morning Glory's copper fades into oblivion, right? Yes. Is that a wood-burning stove? Is there a regular stove, too? Look at that marble top table. It must be for making pasta. Would you possibly consider this? Susan asks. Silence. Then Julia says, I cannot imagine anything more phenomenal. But really, this is fantasy. Camille adds, well worth looking into. I could so completely love this. Think of all the art. She didn't remotely consider this possible. Julia does. Some of life's best decisions are made irrationally. A fireplace, a window, a saffron-colored wall, a view of volcanoes, the thought of a mythic sea just over the hills. The out-of-nowhere idea stirs them. A house in Tuscany, where they know no one. Everything open to reinterpretation. Other weekends follow at Sandcastle. They talk into the wee hours. They reminisce about sororities and apartments with roommates after college. Camille had loved the communal closet at the Kai O house. She's never, before or since, had such wardrobe options. They talk about friends, mistakes they made, biopsies, trips, what it's like being alone. Why, they wonder, after family life ended, didn't more people banish loneliness and live together? Things, they conclude. People can't part with their stuff, their mother's stuff, attics and basements full of stuff. We must be afraid of sharing a kitchen or bath, they realize. Are we like that? Susan wonders. Camille thinks she is, but she becomes so infatuated with the idea of Italy that she backburners the thought. Rising through her, the realization that she must break through. So much talk of women and glass ceilings, hers presses right on her head. She begins to appreciate Susan's drive that she'd been wary of at first. She could learn from Susan. Julia is coiled to spring. She finds the whole concept enchanting. They talk about residency options, the Tuscan coastal towns, and Italy's system of fast trains. She pictures them stepping onto a sleek Italo and speeding through the countryside, eating sandwiches, the green hills flashing by the window. Alone in her room, however, she's sometimes engulfed by waves of fear that Lizzie would need her, waves of hope that Wade would repent, and random waves that wash over, lifting her feet from the sand and tumbling her roughly to shore. Susan sticks to the bright notion, what do I have to lose? Camille backs out in late July. She can't. And Laura works to convince her that she shouldn't. She keeps mentioning Cornwallis Meadows. Charlie, skeptical, says little, although at breakfast one Sunday he remarks that Dad would surely recommend Cornwallis if he could. But he can't, replied Camille. Can he? The idea truly takes root then. Her two friends inspire her more than her own hardwired timorousness holds her back. Yes, she's going. They all decide. Yes. Such an emprise takes time, but was accomplished. Susan opted to close her Chapel Hill house, not sell. At home alone one afternoon, she was reading in the sunroom and experienced an undeniable love for the bronze bars of sunlight hitting the heart pine floors, the design books on the coffee table, the two nails for stockings over the fireplace. Everything happened here. Glorious, good, bad. Her miscarriages before they gave up and adopted. Those sad days lying in bed, leaking out hope. The girls' projects, the kitchen messes from their cookie and fudge attempts. Aaron's golf bags and fishing gear on the back porch. Full, jammed life. Let the house go? Not yet. What if Eva or Caroline wants to come home? She threw a farewell party in her garden and invited all her friends and colleagues. She hired a grad student to come twice a week to flush the toilets, air out the rooms, and pick up flyers on the porch. She trusts her gardener. Her 100 houseplants she put out on the street with a sign, free. Camille offered her car and home to Charlie and his family, and they arranged to rent their little place to a visiting professor from China. She was pleased that Lara finally got over the shock and became excited for her. Charlie, she'd always known of her good boy, would take her side whatever she chose. She told him about the coffin dream, and as a painter, he understood intuitively what it meant. They planned a Christmas visit. How fabulous to introduce Ingrid to Italy. She left behind the urn of ashes. Julia filed for divorce. She wrote Hugh that as of October she'd find someone good to take care of his house, and could he come stay in Tuscany? Because he might like to study the Etruscans. She'd heard nothing from Lizzie and made no contact with Wade, other than the wrenching business of serving him with papers. She made a quiet trip to visit her father, who thought Italy was a splendid idea and asked when he could visit. Her father agreed not to reveal her whereabouts, except in emergency. She did not drive by her house. They all made arrangements, gardens, bank accounts, insurance, goodbyes to baffled friends, medical and dental checkups. All three began online courses in Italian. Hugh's housekeeper's daughter's divorce coincided with Julia's exit, and she was thrilled to move in the day Julia left. Susan had an eye lift and was quite pleased to see her gray eyes widen again. She installed the for sale sign at the beach. Her daughters agreed it was the right time for their mom. Camille practiced watercolors and loved her color studies and experiments with transparency and opacity. Julia wrapped up her recipe testing. Susan sold two stellar properties, then closed her office at Ware Properties. To her surprise, her brother Mike bought Sandcastle. In October, they will fly to Rome. San Rocco. The morning after the arrival of the three women, my neighbor Leo whistled under my study window. His three notes mock a certain bird, a blackbird, that often sings nearby, leading me to the window because I think it's Leo. He knows I'm up early, usually working, but has no concept at all that he possibly could be disturbing an earth-shaking line of poetry. Still in my nightgown, I looked out the window. He was holding a chicken. Buongiorno. Porca miseria, he replied. Pig misery, one of my favorites of the milder Tuscan curses. We have the new neighbors. They have brought a dog. It got out and into my garden. The chicken's head, I noticed now,
was drooped over and limp.
I chased. Candida was squawking to heaven, and it dropped her.
Oh, awful. What are you going to do?
I went to the Villa d'Or and introduced myself. They started fluttering around like chickens when they saw Candida. Americans, like you. Three ladies. One of them raced out in her bathrobe and started chasing the dog.
You must be angry.
Boh, she was ready for the grill. And I have a 3-month rabbit, too. I invited them for dinner tomorrow. You must come, too.
I'm always taken aback by the Tuscans' lack of sentiment for their food sources. Leo has petted that rabbit, carried it in his pocket, fed it tiny bits of lettuce, and now he's ready to skin it and enjoy every bite. Realism, I suppose. Like Margaret's. How much power she gained when describing children in the post-war south of Italy, when she wrote that beatings for wives and boys happened routinely. Incest was not unexpected in the lives of girls. Always the opposite of sensational, her understatement was devastating. Though I cringe now, I probably won't think about the gray bunny when Leo's wife, Aneta, places her boned and stuffed coniglio on my plate. Especially if her sister has made those crisp rosemary potatoes. 12 hours in Tuscany, and the three women already have a dinner invitation. Happens all the time in Dallas and L.A., right? Someone rushing over and inviting you before you've even unpacked? Yes, especially right after you've run over their cat or backed into their mailbox. I must get on to my projects. On my screen this morning, Margaret. When Colin moved in, he'd asked me, "Will we need to buy a chainsaw? Do you think the shutters must be oiled every year? Is that Roman painting of Janus in the museum a fake? How will we get the well tested?" I'd look up from my book. Call Margaret. She would know. Brief bio. Born in 1938 in Washington, D.C., Margaret Merrill graduated from Georgetown University. Except for stays in the United States, she lived in Italy from 1964 until a few months before her death in 2013. She wrote 3 novels, 3 books of investigative nonfiction, and was on staff at Corriere della Sera. She also was a frequent contributor to major newspapers and periodicals in the United States and Great Britain. Stairs to Palazzo del Drago was published in 1968, followed by In the Cold Shadows, 1974, The Taste of Terror, 1979, Sun Raining on Blue Flowers, 1988, World Mafia World, 1994, and La Branda, 2009. Her photographs have appeared in her books and have been exhibited in Italy. She was awarded the Rome Prize, a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Prima Donna Award, and was a finalist for the National Book Award. I leave out the last spectacular act. After writing for a couple of hours every morning, I follow into town my special path that Colin keeps free of brambles. Between 2 ancient cypresses at the edge of my land, a gate opens to a narrow sentiero that winds over the hump of hill, past chariot-wide stone pavers of a Roman road, and down into the village. It's always a slight shock to descend from solitude and views, to drop into the waking-up streets where merchants sprinkle water from plastic acqua minerale bottles and scrub around their thresholds. Trucks hurry in for morning delivery hours. The woman, far gone in dementia, calls greetings from the door of her son's shoe shop. Buondì, tutti. and the toasty fragrance of baking bread drifts out the forno door across the street. San Rocco is set like a brilliant medallion on the lower slopes of Monte San Lorenzo. No other hill town charms me as much. If you've ever read Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities, this could be one of his dreamy fictional creations. What enchants? Maybe it's the Via Fulvio, ancient Decumanus, the classical straight east-west Roman road dividing the town in half and laid to catch the sun. Maybe it's the fountain of diving nymphs and dolphins in the middle of the elliptical piazza. Maybe it's the cluster of cafe umbrellas at one end, and along one long side, three rival restaurants with outdoor tables and menus resolutely posted only in Italian. I appreciate that. The Duomo with frescoes of the Last Judgment anchors the opposite side, and worn marble steps provide locals with a place to sit and watch the inevitable repetition of each day. The Friday market, small and boisterous, pulls me in every week. I visit the fish truck on Wednesday and the porchetta stand on Thursday. Always something tasty to eat. It's a wonder I'm not gargantuan. We have a pastry shop, a book art supply shop, enough clothing stores, a dry cleaners, and three antique shops that draw people from Milan and Rome. Two excellent gelato places and other righteous trattorias scatter along the streets that radiate from the Decumanus, along with two boutiques where chic young women lean in the doorways, managing not to look bored, and branching vicoli, tiny streets, lead to artisan jewelry, a shoe store, and a knitwear designer. 5,000 souls, all particular. And naturally, a few creeps, fascists, and grumps. Though archaeologists flock here to study the Etruscans, the main piazza originally was a Roman circus for chariot races, hence the graceful ellipse. The Romans were grid-minded, but I don't see how this town ever could have been conceived that rigidly, given that the steep terrain requires curves to get from A to B. I guess they gave up on the Cardo, their usual north-south road that intersected the Decumanus. By medieval times, the circus perimeter was built up with rabbity warrens of shops, stands, houses, and later the rambling noble palazzi you still can get lost in. Anytime sewers are repaired or gas lines installed, and most recently fiber optic cables laid, workers discover grain storage wells, vaults, cellars, and sections of Etruscan road. A few of the ancient stone arches still function as doorways and windows of shops. Layers of time happily coexist, one of the comforts of living here. I go to all the cafes because baristas are among my favorite Italians. I love their efficiency and skill. This morning, I'm at Violetta's Bar San Anselmo. She swirls into the foam of my cappuccino the design of a lyre, because she knows I'm a poet. That's another thing I love about Italy. The person making coffee knows a lyre symbolizes poetry. Signora, she tells me, you have new neighbors. Gianni says they are simpatiche, molto simpatiche. Have you met them? No, they only arrived last night. Yes, but already Leo has met them. Is that a rebuke? News travels fast in this town. Violetta probably knew before I did what I would wear today. My out early into town habit comes from Margaret. When we first met, I'd see her on mornings when I walked in. I was trying to establish a writing rhythm, but finding Tuscany too alluring, and I still love to see the town come alive. Walking over the hill, I took my Italian verb book, memorizing conjugations. But when I got to the town gate, I put away my book and concentrated on seeing Anna arranging vegetables, the garbage collector sweeping the street with one of those witch brooms made of twigs, the barber lighting his first smoke, leaning back in his chair with a tabby sleeping on his lap. Often I'd run into Margaret at Barbiato Angelico, where they should, but don't, have a plaque over her regular table. She'd put down her paper and cigarette and motion me to join her. Smoke, smoke, everyone smoked then, not I. Without plan, we began to meet a morning or two a week. She was just as happy without me. The bar soon filled with local people nipping a coffee before work, and with tourists who, assuming no one there speaks English, have conversations novelists cannot resist tuning into. Not surprisingly, I soon saw in Margaret herself the same stunning quality of her writing, the observer with the archaic smile. In comes Gianni, our local taxi driver.
"The women have no men," he tells me. "They are on solo trips. They have come from the south of America, bringing a little dog, Naughty, who peed in the carrier and barked all the way from the Rome airport."
"They have no car?"
"No. But Grazia will sell them her mama's 500 as soon as the brakes are repaired."
"Is that legal?" "I know that it is not, unless they are registered residents." "That Grazia. Maybe she has some scheme that gets around the law. I wouldn't be surprised."
"Why not?"
"Why not?" is the local response to every preposterous proposition. Another thing I love.
"I told them about their famous neighbors, the poet and the architect. You will be friends, as you are of the same country."
"Yes, we're all American. We'll love each other," I laughed. I'm still a foreigner. Always will be. One of the sharp hooks in my flesh when I think of staying forever in this place. If I went back to the shady neighborhood in Florida where I was born and raised, I'd blend like an alligator or mosquito into the landscape with never a thought of being the exile far from home. Colin scoffs at that.
"We're the new people, citizens of the world."
As the day is unseasonably warm, I take my coffee to an outside table on the piazza and open my vellum-bound book. Notes. Will not yet say how she died. Dyer. I'm saying now how she was as a friend. Luminous. What she wrote. Janus. She may or may not have been a courier between Italy and the CIA. She denied. I'm sure she was. She may or may not have been a lesbian. If so, she was a lipstick lesbian, and now who cares anyway? She once humiliated me publicly. Why? Jealousy? She named me in her will. Ferocious generosity. She was drawn to trouble spots. Why? Pushed to the edge, she liked to decide whether to jump. Margaret. Maddeningly elusive, but what a wicked, raucous sense of humor. I miss that. Those 7 years I knew her in Tuscany, she was slippery even in answering basic questions that should not be difficult between friends. Why did you never marry again? You were only in your 20s. She'd pour into a glass a big splash of the martinis she brought over in a mason jar to my house. We only drink wine, but she was always a martini girl. No one could mix one the way she could, or so she believed. She'd laugh. "Tried marriage twice, and after the second crash landing, I thought, this is just not going to work out. As though she were bad at pie crusts. Then she'd noticed the white dahlias I'd planted and warned me that they must be dug out in autumn. They'd never survive the Tuscan winter. With Margaret, conversation was a series of detours. Muddy road ahead. When I start to pay, Violetta tells me that Gianni has bought my coffee. This is a charming San Rocco tradition, and another reason to love this town. A domani. See you tomorrow. Welcome to the hood, Archie. Julia scans the open shelves for the mocha espresso pot she knows must be there. Grazia has left an obsessive inventory, then spots it on the windowsill. For their arrival, Grazia stocked the kitchen with a few provisions. Bread, cheese, prosciutto, coffee, oranges. American canine invasion on the borders. Killing and mayhem. Julia pauses and looks around the kitchen. This is odd. I feel like I have cooked in this room all my life. How simple. And aren't these checked curtains across the lower shelves so characteristic? I've seen them in Italian cookbooks. Brick floors. What are they called? Cotto? Cooked. How practical. Spill anything. Julia is already dressed in jeans and a red sweater, but barefoot. She unrolls the felt pouch of chef's knives that she brought over in her luggage. At Mulberry Press, she was the chef for authors' events, and occasionally she catered parties for friends. I can't believe that huge marble sink. You could bathe two babies in there. Archie, what a disaster. He never saw a chicken in his life. Now on our first morning, he's murdered the neighbor's hen. Oh, what was his name? Leo. He was sweet about it. And now we're going to have to eat the damn chicken. Susan couldn't help but laugh. I cannot believe little goofy Archie has the killer instinct. He's never been out of North Carolina. He is insanely confused. When we go in town, we'll buy Leo something nice. Wine? Camille saws into the bread, prepares a platter with everything Grazia brought, and pours big glasses of blood orange juice. On the long kitchen table, the mound of cheese, rustic bread, and oranges forms a still life. The juice looks dark and powerful. A glass will speed you into the day. They are starving, not having eaten since the exceptionally good sandwiches at a highway grill en route from the airport. Camille begins a list of what they need in town. But since what they need is everything, she starts to sketch the kitchen fireplace. She is already enamored with the house. Winter in this beamed room, she imagines. A fire popping, boiling pasta water steaming the windows. She has not thought of Charles since the plane touched down in Rome. Is he exiled from here? I let him out, Susan is saying. I should have used the leash, but I thought he'd just pop out and back in. She scoops up Archie and whispers in his ear, "You were very bad." And poor Archie whimpers. He so liked the feel of feathers in his mouth. Hey, you two. Gianni is coming at 9. I feel like I'm going to the prom. Archie, my friend, you are staying here. You'll be fine in the kitchen. Susan walks him again, surveying the property as they stroll. A short distance downhill, she finds a stone building with a glass front, a structure she knows to be a storage for lemon trees over the winter. She'd seen one at the famous garden La Gamberaia, when she traveled with Aaron years ago. The long room is full of pots, those gorgeous green glass demijohns you pay a fortune for at Restoration Hardware, spider webs spanning 2 yards, gardening tools, some perfectly good, and rusty iron chairs. Bulbs, she thought. I could plant them now for spring. She has no way of knowing that naturalized daffodils cover the entire hillside in early April. Over many years, Louisa added irises and tulips. Wild orange-spotted lilies thrive in bright clusters. She circles the house. Fruit trees, a couple of lichen-etched terracotta olive oil containers, some roses still sputtering out a few blooms, and many boxwood domes. Johnny must know a good nursery. She visualizes the rusty chairs under the linden tree and lavender and santolina along the drive up to the road. Around the front door, spilling catmint, dusty miller and verbena. Pale pink verbena. Water falling somewhere. Archie scratches in the dirt and begins to root. He looks up, guilty and frantic. What is wrong with you, little one? Camille hangs her clothes in the looming armadio that squawks when she opens it. Her chest of drawers is freshly lined in blue and white fleur-de-lis paper. Because of her knee, she has the downstairs bedroom at the back of the house. Julia's and Susan's bedrooms are in the vast upstairs, where there are 3 others, plus a large room that's used for storage. This house was built for a multi-generational family, not 3 lone foreigners. Out the window, she sees Susan poking her head inside a stone building with arched glass doors. What a great studio! All that sunlight streaming in! She spreads her sweaters and tops around on the bed and begins rolling them, as her efficient daughter-in-law taught her to do. With only 4 drawers, she needs every centimeter of space. This must have been the dead couple's room. It's spare, the original minimalism, really, with walnut chest, armadio, and bed handsome against white walls. She runs her hand over the thick plaster, following the sweep of someone else's hand as he'd smoothed the surface. Her mother wielding the spatula, spreading the boiled frosting on her birthday cake. Her mother would admire the crocheted bedspread of hand-sized snowflakes. For Camille, though she loved the carved bed, that scratchy spread will have to go. She'd also like some good towels. The aqua ones in the bathroom look new but skimpy. She looks around her room. By the bed stands a rickety floor lamp in lieu of a bedside table, and on the chest on the other side, an iron relic with a 20-watt bulb. Don't the Italians read in bed? Cleaning supplies, Julia notes. Ammonia, bleach, Ajax, window cleaner, scouring pads. The kitchen seems well scrubbed. But Julia has the urge to rub down every surface, especially the pantry, where the shelves are slightly sticky under jars of honey and jams that will have to go. The fridge, closed since Tito died, smells like ozone. She looks up words and writes her list in Italian. Wonder if I could find a food processor, or at least a stick blender. How to say that in Italian? She knows she is going to learn the language quickly. Susan has a feel for it, except for rolling R's. When she reads passages aloud, she's taught herself to race through. Her instinct is right. Even if she mispronounces, she speeds on. Tutor, Julia writes at the top of her list. She wants to start immediately. Today she is going to buy a cookbook in Italian. Outside her front bedroom window, the land steps down and down, with a few dots of farmhouses far below. The other window looks east, The full frame of it is filled with a glorious tree, bare of leaves, but gaily hung with burnished and glowing yellow persimmons. Kaki, she learns. The first thing she will cook in the kitchen